And for our passage this morning, we will read for the law our text. It is the first 11 verses of Ecclesiastes. So technically speaking, this isn't law. You don't find commands here. But it does talk about the vanity of life. And so I want us to consider that today because we know that life is vain and fleeting. For one main reason, because we have sinned against God. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuit the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness, a man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been. In the ages before us, there is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. And we'll finish our reading there. We have read the passage. It's Ecclesiastes 1 through 11. And near the end of that, it talks about how there is nothing new under the sun, and the things that are, have been, the things that have been, will be again. And so this is where my mind went as I wanted to think about the beginning of this sermon and kind of open up our series here in Ecclesiastes. This is kind of the way that I actually open up my book on giants, but for very different reasons. Ever since In Search Of came on back in the 1970s with Leonard Nimoy. Now, many of you probably never seen that show, but there's lots of equivalents of it these days. I've been super fascinated with ancient mysteries in our human past. So I wanted to give you some that you've probably never heard of before. First one is discovered in a shipwreck off the coast of Greece in 1901. It's called the Antikythera mechanism. It's an ancient Greek computer that's made up of bronze gears that puts modern watches to shame. It predicts eclipses, keeps a 19-year lunar calendar, shows the current location of the sun, moon, and planets years in advance, if you want it to. And the likes of it would take another 1,600 years to approximate. The Dorchester pot, this one was new to me looking up some of these. In 1851, this is an incredible story, buried at a depth of several meters under the sedimentary rock, a vase jar made of zinc and silver was discovered encased inside a solid rock that was exploded from a hill in Massachusetts. The Bausch map was made in 1739, and it depicts Antarctica, some people say without ice, although I'm skeptical of that one, even though the continent would not be discovered for nearly 100 years. Machine-coiled springs composed of copper, tungsten, and molybdenum were discovered between 1991 and 1993 in the Ural Mountains. These objects are as small as 1/10,000th of an inch and appeared in geological strata 30 feet deep. A battery inside a clay pot discovered in Baghdad in 1936 dates to before 226 AD. And then many of you know about some of these impossibly gigantic megaliths moved dozens of miles down ravines, up mountains with unknown means, scattered across the globe, connected by similar lost technology, cut with machine precision through insanely hard rock, sometimes fitted together as if they were melted, with highly advanced astronomical and mathematical information encoded in their structures. Or how about the earthen mounds found with giant bones, with ornate jewelry that exist by the hundreds throughout much of the eastern third of the United States and a lot of Europe as well. So they call these things uparts, out-of-place artifacts. And none of these are without controversy that I just gave you. But they are the tiniest sampling of thousands of bizarre, unexplained relics and buildings and structures that date from forgotten ancient times on planet Earth. And as far as ancient history is concerned, the relatively near contemporary of Solomon, Hesiod, over in Greece, tells us from his darkened pagan Greek perspective about the ancient days. And this is what he says. First of all, the deathless gods who dwell on Olympus made a golden race of mortal men who lived in the time of Cronos before the flood when he was reigning in heaven, and they lived like gods. Without sorrow or of heart, remote and free from toil and grief, miserable age rested not on them, but with legs and arms never failing, they made merry with feasting beyond the reach of all evils. When they died, it was as though they were overcome with sleep, and they had all good things, for the fruitful earth unforced bare them fruit abundantly and without stint. They dwelt in ease and peace upon their lands with many good things, rich in flocks and loved by the blessed gods. Now, this is something that is a parallel, of course, in the first few chapters of Genesis. And these are obviously people that lived a long, long time ago. Who knows how long? And they did some remarkable things. Now, the biblical version of those days is not a golden age, but it's a gilded age. It was an age of pseudo-spirituality. In fact, false religion. Now, where most English Bibles translate one of the last verses of Genesis 4 as people began to call upon the name of the Lord and put a positive spin on it, it's interesting that the Jewish Targums interpret the word began as pollute. And so they say things like, that was the generation in whose days they began to err and to make themselves idols and surname their idols by the name of the word of the Lord. Or another one says, then in his days the sons of men desisted from praying in the name of the Lord. And that generation, which corresponds theologically in the line of Cain, shows both an epic fall into godlessness and a simultaneously spectacular explosion of technology. Lamech, seventh from Cain, has these sons who all develop at the same time high technology. Jabal creates husbandry and tent making. Jubal creates music and instruments. Tubal-Cain creates the forging of weapons for warfare. All his sons. And an extra biblical Jewish tradition, and I think this is implied in the scripture itself, this corresponds to the fallen watchers or sons of God coming down on Mount Hermon to give us this technology in exchange for our women. In Enoch, this is what it tells us, the angel Gadarel shows us various ways of killing one another. Azazel teaches women how to decorate themselves. Kesadiah teaches women how to have abortions. That's in the book of Enoch. Semiaza teaches enchantments. Barakael teaches astronomy. Kokiel teaches astrology. And it goes on and on and on. And this actually parallels the way the Babylonians understood the history in their equivalent of the story. And I want to add to this, many underwater legends of cities just off the coast scattered all around the world, ancient pre-Diluvian cities intentionally buried in the sands of Turkey like Göbekli Tepe, or massive water erosion on the Great Sphinx that's been sitting there in an arid desert for thousands of years. And when you start to think about these things, you get deep mysteries that many people have forgotten even existed. In that realm of the so-called pseudoscience, which is what scientists love to call this, and it's made a lot of inroads through popular shows like Ancient Aliens and a whole lot of books and documentaries and podcasts on these very fascinating and fun and sometimes foolish but often very addicting subjects, one of the gurus of the day, Graham Hancock, says, we're a species with amnesia. And I agree with that. Now, the thing is, Solomon told us about this a long time ago in our passage. He said, what has been is what will be. And what has been done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new, it has been already in the ages before us? And this comes right before he starts talking about all these things that he started learning and doing. Now, the goal of the mystics and the pagans and the occultists and the New Agers and many pop researchers, when they think about this stuff, seems to be to rediscover our past in hopes of ushering us back into the Golden Age. And whereas there might be some reason to relate our past eschatologically in some kind of a biblical counterpart to the future millennium or the return of Christ, and some people love to do that with these things, Solomon takes the past and he looks at it from a very different point of view. Rather than looking to the past to build a brave new world in the future for ourselves, the preacher is much more concerned with the present and what it means to be here and now. And this is wisdom. And this is how we're going to begin our study of Ecclesiastes. So you can take your Bibles if you want to. We're going to go through the book here, go through the beginning of it. It begins with a superscription, first verse. This introduces us to the author. Now, this is going to parallel at the end of the book, the postscript, which will give us a little bit more biographical information about him as he summarizes the entire book in the last four or five verses of Ecclesiastes. In our verse here, he's called Kohelet, the preacher. That's what the word means. It comes from a verb that means to assemble, and the setting is therefore either a classroom or more likely something like a congregation, exactly like what we're in right now. The word Ecclesiastes is simply the Greek translation of this word. So Ecclesiastes means the preacher. So our preacher identifies himself as the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And most have said that he has to be King Solomon, given that Proverbs begins almost exactly the same way, except for it mentions his name. It says, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. Now, the authorship of the book has been debated since the very earliest days, but maybe the name Solomon is left off because there's a higher and greater author that you're supposed to see here. The Lord Jesus himself calls Solomon a type of himself. He says, the queen of the south will rise up at the judgment with this generation and condemn it, for she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and behold, something greater than Solomon is here. And Jesus, of course, is the King of Kings and the King of the Jews, and he was himself ushered into Jerusalem on a donkey like the kings of old, like, in fact, Solomon himself was, if you go back and read 1 Kings chapter 1. And so the church fathers said things like, Ecclesiastes is Christ, the author of all knowledge. And another one said, the true ecclesiast is he who collects into one body what has been scattered and assembles into one whole those who have been led astray in many ways by various deceits. He's talking about us. So contrary to many people who think that this is merely a Jewish book or some relic of the Old Testament that's no longer for modern people, Gregory of Nyssa says the teaching of this book looks exclusively to the conduct of the church and gives instruction in those things by which one would achieve the life of virtue. And therefore, at the start of our many lessons, I want you to understand that the one from whom you are hearing is no mere man, but God himself, come to preach to you through the human preacher very ancient truths, deep truths, with words that echo down the corridors of time as they leap off the pages of a scroll that has long since been destroyed and yet, by God's grace, has been preserved by the Holy Spirit. You need to hearken to these words, listen to the teaching, and learn wisdom. So after the introductory verse, our passage consists of verses 2 through 11. The words are poetic. They should look like that. They shouldn't be written justified margins in your Bible. They should be looking like poetry. They speak of things that are created. They ring out words that belong to the world that is profane and mundane, by which I simply mean common to all men. And that makes this a subject not spiritual enough for some Christians. And yet it's so omnipresent to our physical reality that those very same people can't escape for a single second their own lives that they live in this. It talks about the sun, the earth, the wind, streams, and the sea. Eyes, ears, work, and labor. All these things are found here. So Norbert Lofink calls it a poem about cosmology. And he sees its parallel near the end of the book with a poem about ethics. I think that we can think of them as reflections in some way upon Genesis 1 and 2, which is why I chose one of the hymns for this morning. The poem also speaks of time, that inescapable jailer who holds all of us captive so that we're never free from his shackles. We all see him, we all hear him, and no one can escape him. Things which have been, things which are now, and some things which have not yet come to pass. These temporal aspects of life are contemplated by the preacher. And hence James Hamilton summarizes this section as discussing the circularity of life. And he sees its parallel also near the end of the book with a second section dealing with youth and old age, so time. Some also see the whole book as being cut in half so that things near the beginning here mirror things near the end of the first half of the book, and things at the beginning of the second half mirror things near the end of the second half of the book, creating kind of two chiasms. And so, for example, if you look at verse 11, it says, "There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after." At the end of chapter 4, it says, "There is no end of all people of whom he led, and yet those who come later will not rejoice in him." So it says very similar things. Now, that's just kind of the way the structure of the book goes, and the question is, who cares? Well, these structures help you understand that we begin where we're going to end, and we're not going to escape the ideas even in the middle of the book. And that means you really need to pay attention right now to what is before us so that when we return to this later, you might better see through the preacher's eyes the new things he will say about the very same things he's talking about in terms of time and God's creation. If you get this now, it will help you later on. So let's start just going through the passage. Have you ever thought about the futility of life? Have you ever struggled with understanding why you are here? Have you ever thought that life often seems meaningless and empty? Now, many people will hear those questions and they will be afraid to answer yes. Those are not very Christian thoughts, Pastor. And you would never dare admit it in public company, and yet this is exactly how the preacher begins. The poem affirms at the outset, "Vanity, vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity." What does that word mean? Well, if you Google vanity, you're going to end up usually with one of two results. The first one is a bathroom sink and cabinet. The second one is a rather lovely singer who Prince made popular in the 1980s, who later became a Christian but died a few years back of kidney disease because she was addicted to Coke for many years. The preacher has in mind neither of those. When you look at the word in the dictionary, the first entry is usually excessive pride in or admiration of one's own appearance or achievements. This is also not what the preacher has in mind, although the topic will certainly come up more than once in the book, so it's kind of conceptually related to it. Here's how other translations render this word: futility. This is often actually the second definition of vanity in the dictionaries. Futility is what he has in mind. Other translations say meaningless or smoke or mere breath, or one even says absurdity. So the word in Hebrew is habel, and it often means a breath or a vapor. And when you breathe, what comes out? Little water vapors. And when it's cold enough, you can see it. And how long does your breath last? A second or maybe two. This then becomes a very profound word. One commentary tells us that it connotes what is visible or recognizable, but unsubstantial and momentary and profitless. There's a lot to ponder here, because the preacher says all things are like this. You can see it right in front of your face. You recognize it. You think you know what it is. You've identified it. You've put a name on it. You've labeled it. You've classified it. You own it. It's yours. And yet the second you try to touch it, it melts. The moment you think you've grasped it, it's gone. The instant you think it's valuable to your life, it's rendered worthless. A couple of us were having a discussion about this passage yesterday. And we're all kind of like, the whole book just seems like that very thing. It's so hard to grasp. Maybe that's on purpose. Not only are these things what is behind the word, but vanity, that word appears 5 times in our one verse. Twice it's in pairs, once it's alone. That creates a total of 3 sets to make for the greatest superlative possible. Think big, bigger, biggest. That's what he's doing. Vanity, vanity. All is vanity. You can see him saying that. That's not the way we usually think a good sermon should begin. Most modern churches would already fire this preacher. And he's only spoken 1 sentence. How dare you going around telling little delicate snowflakes that everything is absurd and meaningless? And I use snowflake there on purpose because what's a snowflake? It's ephemeral, and as soon as you touch it, it melts. See, that wouldn't boost self-esteem to say that. That won't help them make it through COVID and monkeypox. It will only lead to despair and maybe even suicide. But no, this is how the preacher begins. And this is what you need to think deeply upon today. So what does it mean? It means we're going to see the vanity to be grasped in things that exist properly in the physical universe. We're also going to see how vanity is related to time that's quickly passing away for each of us. There may, however, be spiritual overtones in this word. And I want to just talk about this for one moment. Hebel is closely related to another Hebrew word, hebelim. Hebelim appears in the context of the gods on many occasions in the Old Testament. They have made me zealous by no god. They made me angry by their vanities. Vanities is translated by the ESV as idols often. The Old Testament calls the gods vanities. Dictionary of Deities and Demons says, by calling indigenous Canaanite and other deities vanities, their formal existence and practical efficacy are negated. It's like calling them false. It goes on to say that the word, which bears no relationship to any other ancient Near Eastern word, is onomatopoetic. Remember that word? It means it sounds like it is. Habel sounds like breath. And in these other places, the gods are compared to breath and vapor and transiency, and they stand in contrast to the everlasting God of the Bible who made them. And in this way, through the close association with them being virtually the same thing, we can see at this point, just 2 verses in, we can contemplate truly that all things, even those fallen beings like Satan, or even those loyal to the Lord like Gabriel, that when they're compared to the Lord, they are but a breath. That's a lesson Solomon had to learn the hard way at the end of his own life as he became a gross idol worshiper and paid a very serious price for it. Now that said, instead of going in any kind of supernatural direction, the preacher stays with what we can see and feel and hear and touch. In fact, the book is almost exclusively and maybe entirely exclusively dedicated to those things. He certainly knows the reality of the spiritual world, but to him, there's only one spiritual reality worth discussing in this sermon. He has a stock phrase that he will use nearly 30 times to describe it. Under the sun. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils? Under the sun, in verse 3. Now, many ancient peoples worshiped the sun, but that's not what's in mind here. In fact, the phrase appears about as naturalistic as how we, in our post-supernatural rationalism, often think of it. Under the sun is something all humans have in common. Everything we all do is under the sun. It's not specific to Jews or Christians. And this verse is the first question in the book. What's a question do? It makes you stop and think. That's one of the purposes of Ecclesiastes. We aren't supposed to just be spoon-fed all the answers to life. There's far too much of this going on in the contemporary church, and it has created generations of shallow disciples who never learn to think for themselves. We are supposed to contemplate these things. Some may not like to do this because it takes too much effort. But Christianity and life, they think, are supposed to be easy because that's what they're told by their pastors. I just want you to know, if you think that way, I want you to know that searching out the matter, this is the job of a king. Proverbs says, it's the glory of God to conceal things. It's the glory of kings to search things out. And God created us to reign as kings. He has given this status back to the chosen people because we're a royal nation. How does this king begin his book? I'm the king in Israel. How does he end it? My son, listen to my teaching. That means that what we're doing here is royal work, and we're going to proceed that way for the rest of our time. The focus of this question is, in fact, on work. Work is what everyone must do on their journey through life. Even if you don't get paid for it, you still have to work. Now, you can view work rightly. You can think of it as a gift from God that he gave us prior to any sin in this world. Remember Genesis 2? There was no man to work the ground. So God created the man and he put him in the garden to work and to keep it. Work is therefore good and necessary. And it's something that emulates God himself, who worked for 6 days and then he rested. But again, and I might do this to you a lot today, again, this is not the way the preacher is viewing work. Instead, he uses a word much more familiar to 9-to-5ers who every Monday through Friday are singing that Loverboy song in their head, everybody's working for the weekend. The word he chooses is toil. Why do people work for the weekend? Because they hate their work. It's a burden to them. They do it only because they have to survive. Listen to how this word is translated in other places in the Old Testament. Misery, wrong, hardship, wearisome, trouble, and even the word labor has that idea, doesn't it? So the preacher thinks of work here as toil. But the point and the thing that you're to contemplate is not the toil by itself, as if he just wants your affirmation for you to just say, you're right, preacher, work stinks. Rather, he gives you a context. He says, what does man gain by it? And this word is unique in Ecclesiastes. One commentator says, the idea is that of surplus, and the question is asked from the perspective of someone who thinks of life in a particular way, as if it were raw material to be invested in, manipulated and shaped, given added value by what is done with it, and marketed as a means of accruing capital. It's closely related to a word found in the Proverbs where it says, all hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. So now the question can be understood. If work is a great toil, and everybody is engaged in it only for profit, what do you gain by it? Now the preacher is going to return to this thought time and again throughout his sermon. But here, as we see when we keep reading, he does not raise the question and then answer it the way that you might like him to, or the way that you might hear in a modern three-point sermon, especially when we tend to like nicely packaged practical tips that we can walk away from and apply for the week. He doesn't do that. Instead, he seems to change the subject. But I'm going to raise a question here. Does he actually change the subject? And I'm not going to answer that for you. Basically, he's forcing you to think. He begins by presenting a series of observations about the cosmos and the people who live in it. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Now, the meaning of the word generation is disputed, but the ESV goes with that in the traditional sense. It just means people. People are born and people die. And this is cyclical, and it's never ending. It happens to each person in every generation that has ever lived. John Cougar Mellencamp dedicated his most famous album, Scarecrow, to his grandfather who had just died, and he wrote this: "There is nothing more sad or glorious than generations changing hands." He apparently was still thinking about this 2 years later when he put this very passage on his record jacket of his Lonesome Jubilee album, and even Rolling Stone admitted that it was one of many biblical references found in the record. It's interesting to me, all these secular people thinking about Ecclesiastes. In saying this, the preacher is contrasting the impermanence of humans over and against the permanence of the inanimate world. Now, Jerome observed a great irony here. He said, "What is more vain than this vanity, that the earth, which was made for humans, stays, but humans themselves, the lords of the earth, suddenly dissolve into the dust?" We might imply meaning from this, like the famed medieval Rabbi Rashi did when he said that the wicked will not outlive the wealth they gain by oppression, because their generation will pass away and another will come and take their wealth away from their children. But the humble who inherit the earth shall endure. That's what he saw in this verse. And I thought, well, at this point in Ecclesiastes, it hasn't even talked about that. I think he's getting ahead of ourselves here. Instead of being practical again like that, he continues with a litany of observations and move to other parts of the creation. And this fits with the other possible meaning of the word generation, which is that it doesn't refer to humans, but to cycles of nature. He just mentioned the earth. Now he's going to talk about the sun and the wind and all the streams and the sea. And there's a parallel at the end of the book where he talks about the waters and the earth and the clouds and the wind and the sun. The first one here, verse 5, "The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises." Now, we've all seen sunrises and sunsets, but I don't think we often in our modern world go out and intentionally wake up early enough to go see one just on purpose and just to contemplate it. Henry David Thoreau did, and he came away saying, "Who looks into the sun will see no light else, but also he will see no shadow. Our life revolves unceasingly, but the center is ever the same, and the wise will regard only the seasons of the soul." So the transcendentalist poet looks at the sun and he tries to derive some kind of a meaning. That's what we expect from contemplation, but not so with our preacher. The best we can derive from what we've seen so far might simply be that the day goes as the day goes and the night comes. It just means we're another step closer to never seeing another sunrise. The preacher's not answering how we might derive meaning from this. He simply observes that the sun rises and sets and hurries back to where it came from. This is the cycle of creation that God made, and it has continued unabated since the day he put the sun in the sky. Tremper Longman gives you the sense of the vanity of this. He says, "Ancient Egyptians thought of the sun as conveyed on a ship during its nocturnal journey from west to east, and the Greeks pictured Helios driven by steeds on its daily circuit. According to Psalm 19:5, the sun leaves its chamber like a bridegroom and returns like a strong man, having run its course with joy. Kohelet's description lacks this mood of celebration and wonder. Instead of picturing a vigorous champion who easily makes the daily round, he thinks of strenuous panting to reach the destination. Having arrived, an exhausted sun must undertake the whole ordeal again." The next verse is about the wind. "The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind. On its circuits, the wind returns." Now, this spring, I think we all know, has been by far of the windiest we've ever seen. Is anybody else sick of it? We've had like 4 nice days in a row. It's been so incredible. This wind has been maddening. They say in the early years of the pioneers that the number one cause of death in Wyoming was suicide because of the wind. That's why hardly anyone lives there to this day. Bob Dylan thought a lot about the wind, asking all kinds of questions about life. And he said, "The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind." The German group The Scorpions watched the Berlin Wall fall to the ground, and they sang about the winds of change. But the preacher still isn't seeking meaning of this the way that we hunger for that kind of application. Rather, he's talking about vanity and vapor. The wind blows here. The wind blows there. And it blows, and it blows, and it blows. And then it returns to its circuits. Now, it's not just that the wind blows here and there. Where does it say the wind blows? South and north. Isn't that interesting? Because what's the previous verse talking about? The sun, and where does it traverse the sky? East and west. So the wind is contrasted with the sun, and both return to where they started, only to begin the cycle again. It just keeps on going, over and over, day after day. It never changes. It never stops. It's vanity. He says, all streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. Now, Dan Fogelberg ends his first album saying, I was born by a river. I was raised by a river. I ran far from the river. I'm going to die by a river. And again, this is a man taking creation, trying to see meaning in it. And that's fine, and it's a great song, but the preacher isn't doing that. He raises two significant problems that we need to think about for a moment that cause the minds of children to wonder in awe, probably not so much us adults. One question is, how can you have all these rivers that never stop flowing going into the same place, and yet the sea never fills up? You could think of Grand Lake with the Colorado River constantly feeding it, but of course Grand Lake has an outlet where the waters continue to go on down their course. What about something like the Dead Sea with the Jordan always pouring water into it, and yet the Dead Sea has no outlet? Why does it not fill up? If I put a cup of water under a faucet, the cup quickly fills. That's not what happens with the Dead Sea. And yet its water source never stops. How is that possible? The other question is, how do these streams themselves keep giving water? How is it that a river is always flowing and never runs dry? It always has water. If you go down to the Mississippi River, where Missouri or Arkansas or Louisiana are, you might see that that river at one point reaches 11 miles wide. And you look at it and you think, where does all that water come from? And you follow it all the way up to the headwaters at Lake Itasca in northern Minnesota, and you can walk across it. And you put the two together and you wonder, how can a lake like that create a river like that? The Colorado River, to me, is even stranger. The thing cuts through the mighty Grand Canyon and makes its way into the Pacific Ocean, where the river's delta in a flood time is 20 miles wide. But you can walk right up to the Colorado National Park and hop across its headwaters, where it's a couple inches deep and a couple feet wide. How can a river that created the Grand Canyon start like that? Where does all the water come from? How can it never end? Now, those questions are wonders. And of course, most of you know the answers because you've been to school. But in answering the question scientifically through things like evaporation, Pastor, don't you know, or condensation, you're missing the point of Ecclesiastes. You're taking away the wonder. His point is that this is vanity. They just keep on giving and receiving water, and it never ends. It's the same as with the wind and the sun and the earth with its generations who come and go. Now, perhaps this very thought was in the preacher's head as he raises the next observation. He says, all things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The very moment a puzzle is produced, what do? We want to find its solution and its answer. The eye and the ear are brought into the discussion because this is how we gather information through our senses. That's how we know about the earth and the sun and the winds and the sea in the first place. We're always seeking more things. Show me this and tell me that. I think there's more here, though, than even that. The eye and the ear cause us to want and want more and want more, and it never ends. This is like nature, which is relentless in its movement and ineffectual in its changing itself. The preacher is saying, all things are like this. This produces weariness. Now, the band Cake hits the nail on the head with their song, Sick of You. Weariness. When they sing this, every shiny toy that at first brings you joy will always start to cloy and annoy. Every camera, every phone, all the music that you own won't change the fact that you're all alone. Every piece of land, every city that you plan will crumble into tiny grains of sand. Everything you find that at first gives you shine always turn into the same old crime. I'm so sick of work. I'm sick of play. I don't need another day. I need to fly away. That's what he's talking about, weariness. And the preacher turns his attention now away from the ontological things to the things themselves. He moves them to time in which they find themselves. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. Now, I think there's two huge pitfalls people immediately fall into with this verse. One is ignorance of history. Some know nothing about ancient history, and so they think that everything I said at the beginning of this sermon is just quackery, foolishness. Those things don't exist. This is what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery. Others know nothing about recent history, and so they're doomed to repeat it. That itself is also vanity. We can think of many bad examples that we're being doomed to repeat right now, particularly seeing the dangers of this vanity express itself in worldwide fascism that clothes itself in new garbs, but it's the same old thing we saw in Germany and Italy and other places, all because so many people are obliviously running headfirst into it, thinking they found utopia. If you don't know that these things have been, then you can't understand anything that these verses are telling you. There's another problem, which is taking these verses and trying to pursue the knowledge of our ancient past with the goal of understanding and then applying them to the modern world. In the deepest conspiracies that have been carried out since the Tower of Babel, men are seeking knowledge, long lost, especially esoteric knowledge, in the hopes that they might take that knowledge and make a world a better place for themselves. This can become an addiction to pursue ancient mysteries. I brought them up at the beginning because I find them interesting and because a lot of people do not think they even exist. But why does he bring this up now? It's not to have us try and figure out what was in the past so that we can reproduce it in the present or the future. That's the way a lot of people treat it. In fact, he does the opposite. It's so that you will understand that you can't do anything truly new. As a Canadian group sings in one of their ecclesiastical moods, it's all been done before. And where are all those people now? They're dead and gone. There's no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of latter things yet to be among those who come after. And as crazy and insane as COVID, the vaccine, the elections, the riots, the media, all of the last 2 years have been, and as even more crazy as I think it's likely to get, and as much as it sometimes feels like this is the craziest time in human history, even if it turns out to actually be that way, give it 100 years. Give it 10,000 years. For some people, even though they're right in the middle of it, they've already forgotten. They don't remember much of what's going on, even if they ever knew it to begin with. This is the verse that ends our poem. That's how it ends. How absurd and futile is this? We work and we toil and we gain nothing because we die. Generations come and generations go. The sun is always working hard to simply do the same thing the next day. The wind's constantly changing, but blows for who knows what purpose, only to return and do it again. The water's never running empty, don't fill anything up. We humans love to try and puzzle things out like these, but it's a wearisome task. There's no end of our inquiry or our want, and yet everything we do has already been done. We can't do anything new. Even if we did, no one would care to remember it. Likewise, leastwise us who will pass with our own generation. This is the way of it as our eyes see and our ears hear. It is vanity. And my question to you now is, are you wanting answer to these things now? Why are they raised here at the beginning of the book? Are you looking for some kind of a positive spin here at the end of my sermon? I have a different ending in mind for us today. Perhaps you're just here because you have to be and you don't care at all. I have the same ending in mind for you. I want the power of his observations to hit you so that you will either think on them or not and just go away. I'm going to tell you a story. A long time ago, I was a youth pastor, and we had a bunch of kids that just didn't give a hoot about anything I was talking about ever. That happens in youth groups. Week after week, this was so. So one week, I decided to read Jesus' parable of the sower. You know, the one where the Lord finishes by saying that he tells them parables so that people will be ever hearing and never perceiving. So I read the parable, and then I told them that we're done. And it took all of 2 minutes. I said, go home. And they didn't believe me. So I said it again, go home. I was serious. I said, call your parents. We're done. And many of them did, and they went home. I hope that's not you today. Importantly, a handful stayed, and they wanted to know what on earth I was doing. And so for the next hour and a half or 2.5, I don't remember, it was a long time, time just flew, we had one of the best Bible studies I've ever had because they were hungry for truth. They were thinking. They were reflecting. Now, the preacher has given you truth here at the beginning of his sermon, and he ends it here with there being no remembrance of things that were or things that will be. The Jewish commentator Robert Alter says of this, this is a radical and deeply disturbing idea for the Hebrew imagination, which on the evidence of many earlier texts sets such great store in leaving a remembrance. You're supposed to leave a remembrance to your family. And he envisages the wiping out of remembrance as an ultimate curse. As you leave, will you forget what you've heard? Or will you ponder it, as Kohelet has asked you to do? I hope that you'll do the work of a king and you'll search out the meaning of vanity. And then as we return to these ideas later, I pray you'll come to know wisdom. Let's pray together. Father, a very interesting text for us to preach and try and think through, and for me to try and do justice to and not want to run and ahead of him. That's going to be temptation probably until we get to the end of chapter 12. I pray, Lord, that you would work in the lives of each of our hearts as we've thought about many things here today and as we ponder the world that is around us and the times that we're living in and the difficulties of life, the things that are on a regular basis, things we see every single day, as we try and make sense of the world that we're living in, as we ourselves might be going through a time of wondering what the point is, or as we deal with friends who are asking those kinds of questions as well. We need to be a people who are made wise by your word. And you've given us this as your word to do that very thing. And this is the introduction to this great book. And this is how it decides it's going to make us wise. And these are the words of our very Savior himself, who is the embodiment of wisdom. So I would ask that you would work in a unique way in our hearts as we think about what we've heard today, and that you would apply your word in a way that will be beneficial for each of the people that are sitting here today. We ask mostly that because of it, and we see the vanity that's all around us, that we recognize that there's one thing that we can do in the midst of it, and that is to give you praise and glory and honor. Because you alone will not pass away, and you are always there for us. And we thank you for how you give us this remembrance here at the sermon, in the Lord's Supper, as we come to this in the table after the sermon, that we might indeed remember what Christ has done, and there will be a remembrance of it in your church until he returns. So we ask these things in Christ's name.